Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor John Kasich raised the specter of tapping Ohio's natural resources in December when he announced his pick of David Mustine to lead Ohio's Department of Natural Resources.
I think it'll be a new day for Ohio's natural resources.
But the details of that new day and the impact on Ohio's natural resources are just coming into focus. On January 16th, Mr. Mustine said he was leaving open the idea of drilling for oil and gas in Ohio's state parks and preserves. The state faces a massive budget deficit, perhaps as much as $8 billion, and the agency Mustine now leads is struggling with an estimated $560 million backlog of repairs to its parks. Selling the drilling rights could generate precious revenue. But what are the risks? That's what we're going to talk about today. We invited representatives from both the Ohio EPA and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. Both declined our invitation. We'll keep asking. One of the issues we'll get into is that of fracking, particularly horizontal fracking, a process by which shale underground is fractured to mine the natural gas. Joining us for that more detailed discussion will be Nadia Steinzer of Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project. Joining us now is Cheryl Johncox. Cheryl joined the staff of Buckeye Forest Council last spring and recently was named executive director. The Buckeye Forest Council is a membership-based grassroots organization dedicated to protecting Ohio's native forests and their inhabitants. Its work emphasizes long-term forest preservation and low-impact recreation over logging, oil, and gas drilling. Welcome to the show, Cheryl.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you for having me.
Also with us today is Tom Stewart. Tom is the executive vice president of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. He's held that position for 20 years. The Ohio Oil and Gas Association is a statewide trade association with more than 1,500 members who are actively involved in the exploration, development, and production of crude oil and natural gas in the state of Ohio. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you. Good to be here.
In a report by Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio State House Bureau, Governor Kasich sees more than just revenue from drilling. He believes that the attraction of natural resources could bring other businesses and more jobs to hard-hit eastern Ohio.
Kasich says Ohio is rich in resources that could possibly help the state come out of the economic downturn it's been facing. He says, take that shale that lies in the eastern counties of Ohio, for example. Kasich says there could be a valuable natural resource there.
If there, in fact, is gas, it will be cheap. Businesses, most likely, who are looking for energy sources may want to locate there. That's not directly related to drilling, but it's the offshoot of it.
So, Tom Stewart, it's about more than just the natural resources and the revenues. Is that a selling point that you try to make?
And I say that it's a very strong selling point. Little-known secret to many Ohio industries' commercial concerns is that there's natural gas that is being produced right outside their facilities. So local production is estimated by one independent financial study in Ohio on the industry that saves Ohio consumers about $60 million a year. And that's because the use of that natural gas and the fact that it's a local resource and the fact that they can see that resource right outside their window saves them from acquiring the supplies from, say, areas like the Gulf of Mexico and avoiding all those long-haul transportation charges associated with that. And when there is force majeure incidents, like when hurricanes come into the Gulf of Mexico, or it's very exceedingly cold, that gas is already here for those businesses instead of the pipeline calling up and saying we can't deliver. That is why often you see commercial concerns that are not necessarily involved with oil and gas coming in and supporting our issues because they want to see the continued development of natural gas resources close to them.
Now, when Governor Kasich was talking about that in that report by Joe Engels, he was talking about eastern Ohio, the Mahoning Valley particularly. He was up in at the Lordstown GM plant the other day chatting about that and trying not to get ahead of himself, he kept saying, because there's lots of hopes and dreams for up there. There's apparently some that Utica shale the drillers are, you know, the oil and gas industry is very interested in. But, you know, we're talking about the state parks now. So when you talk about attracting the kind of jobs you were mentioning, bringing industry closer to where these wells are, where they could be, that's not necessarily what you're talking about. You don't want to really bring industry to the doorstep of our state parks and preserves.
That's a good point that you bring out. The issue is there local production flowing into the local transportation grid, into the utilities of Ohio and the gathering systems and the transmission systems that are feeding primarily up and down eastern Ohio, though you'll find Utica beyond that. So it's not necessarily where the reservoir is located, but it's where the reservoir is feeding into the transportation grid, and then these local concerns would tap into that. The deal up in Youngstown is that they took a dormant steel plant that a lot of jobs were lost, and they rejuvenated it primarily to make oil field tubulars, because there's this huge market for casing, steel casing, particularly in the Marcellus of Pennsylvania. So they seized that opportunity to get that plant going and started moving those products over into the oil fields of Pennsylvania and New York.
Is the Marcellus a type of shale? Is that a place?
Marcellus is a Devonian shale that lies above the most commonly drilled formation in Ohio, which is the Clinton Sandstone. And then the Utica is deeper than that. It's below the Clinton Sandstone, but above the Ordovician Res Run, which is another very common target. We've been penetrating the Utica shale for years, but it hasn't been until recent that the technology was available to exploit that resource.
And is that the horizontal fracking that we're going to talk about later?
There's no such thing as horizontal fracking. There is horizontal drilling,
which
is an attempt to expose in a single hole more of the rock face into a single well. So it's much more efficient, but it also exposes the wellbore to much more of the resource. Fracturing is a very old technology. It's been around since 1947. We've been fracturing wells in the state of Ohio since probably 52. I estimate close to 80,000 wells have been hydraulically fractured in the state of Ohio. It happens every day.
Okay. We'll get to that, later on.
Sure.
Just want to remind the folks that my guests are Tom Stewart, Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association, and also Cheryl Johncox. She is Executive Director of the Buckeye Forest Council. Cheryl, the state parks are broke. They have been actually squeezed for many years now. They may need to be closed for lack of funds to operate or upgrade the facilities there. The revenue from the drilling could be the answer.
Well, what I have to say is there's a lot of numbers out there that show that visitation to our state parks is up remarkably over this recession. And we have a lot of challenges. Everyday people are facing challenges in their lives, and our government at both the national and the state level are facing challenges. I don't think that a rush to open the door for exploitation to our state parks is the answer. I don't think that that answer keeps parallel to the increased visitation that our state parks are visiting. I was turned down. I had to, find a private campground last year at least three different times when I tried to get a campsite at our state parks. So in the conservation world, and in the travel and tourism industry, they've coined a new phrase, and that's staycation. So lots of folks in Ohio are flocking to our state parks and our state forests in their inability to do that Bahama cruise. So I know that in 2009, visitorship was up by almost 14%. So they don't have the statistics out for this past year, but I imagine that we will see another increase in the visitation of our state parks, and I don't think that exploiting the oil and gas resources under our state parks, it runs parallel with that visitation. I think when you look at the environmental impact and the impact to recreation and the birding, the fishing that goes on at our state park, I think that those things aren't going to be they're not going to run very, very well together.
There has been an increase in visitor numbers at the state parks, and people do attribute it probably to the staycation mode. And during this economic downturn, they have talked about increasing fees for visitors, but keeping pace with that increase, because with increased visitors, there's increased upkeep, there's increased operational requirements. What about fee increases to make up for it? Do you think it can bring in the kind of money that the oil and gas drilling could?
Well, I have to say, last year when I stayed at our state parks, it was about $35 for a campsite, which is pretty comparable to a private, privately owned campground. That was for a tent camper. And indeed, it would price a lot of Ohioans out of being able to rent a space. Mm-hmm. I think there are other innovative things we can do. I know last year they talked about instituting a what you bring in, bring out program. So, you know, to try and alleviate some of the employment costs of having people come in to collect their garbage, that type of
right.
thing. I think there are also answers, and I know that they're moving into this in some of the southwestern states where they're partnering with local communities to handle part of the maintenance of the state parks. And I came across some information that says there are over 55 local community groups that are now contributing to maintenance at our state parks and upkeep. So I think there are, you know, there are other answers that we can come up with. Besides having to impact the resource and that may inhibit both the environmental quality of our state parks and our recreational value.
Tom Stewart, you've said that the state could take in as much as $30 million a year from lease payments and royalties from wells in the parks. How do you calculate that? How many wells are you talking about when you calculate something like that?
Probably the first question that's always asked is, what will it produce? And since the parks don't have the statutory authority in law, which is really what the debate at the legislature will be about, since they don't have that
they
authority.
They have to first grant that authority
via
the legislature,
first they have to be delegated the authority to even enter into those arrangements. The Forestry Department division already has that authority. In fact, does on occasion do leasing of oil and gas, and Department of Highways does it on a regular basis, but they're always pretty much private transactions based upon request, particularly when it comes to large public tracts like what would happen with lands like forestry or parks. You know, our view is that it ought to be an open and transparent process. The public can fully view it. It ought to be open bidding so that citizens of the state of Ohio can realize the highest value. It shouldn't be a private transaction. In response to the rush, we've been talking about public properties in Ohio now for a very long time, 10, 15 years. The past three General Assemblies have all seen various legislative efforts to explore the subject, all of which obviously have not been enacted to date, but there's a long legislative track record considering this issue. So there's really no rush forward, and there is, and it'd be improper in my view to characterize it as the answer. I think there's no one thing that is the answer to state budgetary problems or the problems of the Department of Natural Resources to keep their facilities up to speed. But I do know that, for example, in the state of Michigan, they've been doing public land leasing for over 81 years. And three or four decades ago, they put all that money into a public land trust that purchases even more land. And when it reaches a certain level, then they spin off money for improvements, capital improvements, and maintenance. So Michigan is a great example of where they've taken that resource and actually used it to expand the public resource and maintain it. Last year, they did 170, their record lease sale, $178 million. On one lease sale in the state of Michigan, went back into the trust and generated a lot of revenue to get
these
to
are
get
at
help.
State parks?
This is on state-owned property in the state of Michigan. I'm not sure whether you would call it parks or forest or what have you. And in Pennsylvania, in the state forest of Pennsylvania, just about a year ago this time, they did a $128 million lease sale that wasn't the answer. It filled a budget hole for the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, last spring, the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources auctioned off nearly 500,000 acres of state forest and parkland for deep oil and gas drilling. That was roughly a quarter of the state's forest land. The only notice was a legal ad for bids in some local newspapers. Public input was not sought. Again, there was no environmental analysis regarding the proposed sell-off. That is not what you're endorsing right now.
No, I'm not endorsing that. What my association is endorsing probably is something that the Buckeye Forest Council, if they had to live with this proposal, would probably support, which is a very open and transparent process in which everybody has their ability to weigh in on the issue.
We're going to get back to that $30 million estimate after our break. We have to take a quick break. My guest, Tom Stewart, he's Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Also with us, Cheryl Johncox. She is Executive Director of the Buckeye Forest Council. We're talking about proposals out there that look brighter than ever to tap the natural resources underground at Ohio State Parks and refuge areas. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have a question or comment, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your all-day NPR news station. Listen to local and national news all day, every day. And you can hear the best in classical music on the new Classical 101. Listen to your favorite composers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's 89.7 NPR News and Classical 101 from WOSU Public Media. For more information, visit WOSU.org.
It's 28 degrees in downtown Columbus. A slight chance of a little snow today. No accumulation. Otherwise cloudy skies and a high near 30. Clouds tonight and a low of 20 degrees. A slight chance of snow on Thursday, a high of 29. And then there's a 40% chance of snow Thursday night. Cloudy skies, a low of 23 degrees. And looking ahead to Friday, clouds and a high of 33. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guests, Cheryl Johncox. She is Executive Director of the Buckeye Forest Council. Also, Tom Stewart. He's Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. We're talking about proposals to drill for oil and natural gas in Ohio State Parks. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go on to Facebook, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can Twitter us, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Tom, let's get back to that estimate that you've put out there that the state could get taken as much as $30 million a year from lease payments and royalties from wells in the parks. Where are you getting that number from? How many wells are we talking about?
Well, of course, always, as we talked about earlier, there's always people asking what can be had.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done two analysis on that. One was focused in on Salt Fork Park, which seems to be the poster child for the debate. And it's a very large park, bigger than a township. It is surrounded 360 degrees by intense oil and gas development that's been there for a long time, all of the wells which have been hydraulically fractured. And you know, the probably because fluids and gas move through rock, we're probably already, those wells are probably already draining the perimeter of Salt Fork Park. And so unless some competition to that drainage takes place, you know, every day the state's resources is just ever so slightly diminished. So that's a business decision they're going to have to make. But we went and we looked at the total amount of acreage, about 600,000 acres that the state owns. You divide the state in half, you cut that down to 300, and then finally say about 150,000 acres of that would be prospective for development. And then what would that mean based upon a very common reserve analysis of natural gas in the Clinton Sandstone? So that was an analysis that was based solely on drilling to the most common formation in the state of Ohio. Mm-hmm. The Silurian-Clanton Sandstone did not take into account shallower formations, which exist primarily in southern Ohio, or the deeper Rose Run or Beekmantown, which would flow right through Salt Fork Park. And it certainly didn't take into account any shale development, the impact of the Utica, which is a game changer, as we discovered in Michigan. And
so $30 million comes from, is there a number of wells that you're estimating? I mean, how does that...
What we said is, based upon boiling that down to 150,000 acres, based on 150,000 reserves, that the lease bonus payments would be $20 million off the bat and a royalty of $300 million based upon a 1/8 royalty rate over the period of about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is what we testified to in the last General Assembly.
Cheryl?
Yes. You know, with regard to the number of wells, especially with hydrofracking, research indicates that, you know, they can put as many as 10 well heads on a platform. The Nature Conservancy just came out with an excellent report, Pennsylvania Energy Impact Assessment. It was done by the Nature Conservancy in Audubon, Pennsylvania. They estimate that resource development in Marcellus Shale could impact their forest land cover in the hundreds of thousands of acres just for transmission lines. They estimate the impact of a well pad to be in the area, in a forested area, to be on the magnitude of 30 acres of forest for one well pad. So these are things that we're concerned about. These are just impacts to the forest. We also have four impacts that would be need to be considered to wildlife, to our water resources, to endangered species, the possibility of fault lines that is not a very very well understood. But, you know, these formations that we're talking about are so deep that fracturing – if fracturing happens and there's a fault that hits, those contaminants that are contained in that literally can be 1 to 5 million gallons of fluid that are used for the hydrofracking process. That can travel right up those fault lines, enter into our groundwater, and even make it into springs and open waterways. Those are things that we're concerned about for our state parks. We have state parks. They're located mostly in rural areas. Those areas, those state parks often have water supplies that come from wells, and those wells would be then susceptible to contamination. I appreciate the fact that, you know, we're not talking about the only solution is oil and gas drilling in our state parks. But, you know, I would like to draw attention to the fact that the natural gas industry is currently enjoying unacceptable federal exemptions from most landmark environmental and health policy laws, including the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, the Toxic Release Inventory under the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. So I think that these are some of the things that we're talking about when we're talking about a rush to drill at our state parks. We have concentrations of Ohio citizens that are vacationing in these areas. We think that there should be safeguards in place. We think that these should be areas where we can enjoy safe recreation with our families.
Cheryl, Tom mentioned it earlier. I think it's Salt Fork, and there's probably others that are literally surrounded by hundreds, it looks like, of these drill sites.
Mm-hmm.
How is that, if there was a lot of impact from them, why isn't it showing up in the state parks already?
Well, the impact for the Salt Fork region, like he was saying, it literally is, you know, tens of thousands of acres right there itself. Salt Fork, and these well pads can drill up to a mile in any direction from that vertical depth,
mm-hmm.
So horizontally. So I'm not saying that every well has impacts on the natural environment. I am saying that there are risks involved and that our state parks should be places that we know that we can safely vacation with our families and not have to worry about those risks. And I have here the Range Resource Corporation report to the SEC where they warned their stockholders in May of 2006. This is the biggest hydrofracking company in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
They provided the SEC with a prospectus in which they warned their stockholders that our business is subject to operating hazards, environmental regulations that could result in substantial losses or liability Oil and gas operations are subject to many risks, including well blowouts, explosions, uncontrollable flows of oil, natural gas, well fluids, fires, formations of abnormal pressure, pipeline ruptures or spills, pollution, releases of toxic natural gas, and other environmental hazards, including injury and loss of life, damage and destruction of property, pollution and environmental damage and cleanup responsibility.
Let Tom respond to some of this. Tom?
Be happy to. First off, we need to decide whether the industry is regulated or not. Cheryl made the statement that the industry enjoys exemptions from the landmark federal laws. That is a fully inaccurate and a distortion point of view. It is fully regulated under Clean Water Act. Clean Water Act delegates authority to the states related to impacts on surface streams. That regulation is fully in place and represented in Ohio law and federal law. We are fully regulated under Safe Drinking Water Act because Safe Drinking Water Act deals with the disposal of produced waters. That process is fully regulated under Safe Drinking Water Act. The treatment of the industry under Resource Conservation and Recovery Act is famous, and it was the intent of Congress and EPA that regulation be exposed to Subtitle D, but that regulation ought to be delegated to the states because that's the proper place to be. You can go to almost any landmark federal law, environmental law, and find out how the industry is specifically treated under there. But they keep going about it. But listen.
Before you move on, though, because I do want to give you a chance to respond, but the Ohio General Assembly did pass legislation last session.
Be happy to talk about
it. It was intended to update the regulatory framework surrounding oil and gas drilling. What changed for the industry last year?
Senate Bill 165.
Or last session, I should say.
Senate Bill 165, which was enacted in March of 2010, was probably the most significant amendment to Ohio's oil and gas law since that chapter was created in 1965. It did major upgrades to the urbanized drilling program. It did major upgrades to national issues that are swirling
around
the country.
And when you say upgrades, what do you mean by that? Like benefiting the industry or benefiting the environment?
I think it benefited the Ohio public because the issue was, should the Ohio public have faith and trust in the regulatory process? Because the real issue here, and listen, anytime you drill a hole in the ground to expose a reservoir to the hydrocarbons in it, Cheryl is absolutely right. There is risk. So the issue is, do you manage the risk or do you eliminate the risk? If you eliminate the risk, then we're not going to have any oil and gas in this country.
That means no drilling.
And so we're not going to really like the lifestyle that would generate. So what you need is risk that's managed by experts. And Senate Bill 165 looked at the modern issues. Hydraulic fracturing, which the big one really is well construction practices and non-producing wells, and then, of course, funding for the oil and gas regulatory program. And 165 did that, and 121 out of 132 members of the Ohio General Assembly voted to approve 165. And was watched across the United States as Ohio sort of led the nation in advancing the modern debate dealing with oil and gas development and coming up with Ohio's solution to national issues. Hydraulic fracturing was right in the middle of that, and full disclosure of hydraulic fracturing, even to the extent of the pressure charts related to the frack job, are all submitted as part of the public record, and the constituents are all submitted as part of the public record.
I want to get some emails. One from Shane. Regardless of the benefits of drilling, I have to invoke the slippery slope argument. It's terrifying to think about continuing the degradation of our already compromised natural areas. There are private lands that already get drilled for fossil fuels, and the odor permeates the neighboring areas as well. It's quite disturbing and could negatively impact all visitors to parks. So there's a couple things in there. One is the degradation of our already compromised national areas. When a well is drilled and it's successful and then you empty it and it's no longer active, what happens to the property there?
That's why I urge the legislature and have been urging public policy people interested in this issue that they need to take those issues into consideration and understand the impacts. When you're drilling an oil and gas well, usually in the state of Ohio, there's a rig there for a week. Now, Cheryl's or most of her members are not going to like that rig being there for a week. But then after a week, it's gone. What's important is
What's left? Anything?
What's left is a wellhead that produces oil and gas.
And what
we all need to be concerned about is that if somebody wants to seize that opportunity, then those people need to be required, pursuant to the law and the regulations that would build around this program, that is properly screened, maintained, so that the public has trust that this activity is taking place. But the bottom line is that it's taking place all around Salt Fork Park, but Salt Fork Park isn't enjoying that same process.
What about the odor that the emailer mentioned?
Well, in the urban drilling program, they talk about odors to a great deal, and there is many easily done technologies today where you can contain those odors within the production facilities. You can screen that out, put on filters, and you're not going to notice it.
Cheryl?
I actually have an email here from one of my members who lives near Chillicothe. She lives in 1.58 acres right outside of Tower Hollow State Forest. She sent me an email that says on December 21st, she noticed a drilling rig on her neighbor's property approximately 150 to 200 feet from her home. She called their local health department and was very surprised to find out that this was not a drilling rig for a water well, but for hydrofracking. She said she spent sleepless nights because of continuous noise coming from the rig. She's videotaped it at 2 p.m., which is midnight, 3 a.m., 5 a.m., and she couldn't sleep. She finally had to receive sleeping aid from her doctor. She called the local health department. She called DNR. She did investigate and tried to figure out, why there would be allowed to be a drill so close to her home. She said on January 22nd, now this is almost a month later. Mm-hmm. On January 14th, her son called her, 14-year-old son, and said that he came home from school and that the house smelled funny and that he was dizzy. She called the sheriff's office. They dispatched the local fire department. They said they could only read CO2, and that they did the CO2 reading. They found no CO2 present, but did agree that the fumes were strong. They went to speak to the rigging crew. The rigging crew said that they were hitting pockets of gas and they had a burn pot going, but it was cold, the gases were low, and there was nothing they can do about it.
Okay, so this is the impact. You're saying that the real impact it has on people.
But DNR did not come out to do an air test for a week to find out what was actually happening. The rig did shut down. But by the time that our Department of Natural Resources came out to do a test was a week later. I'm sure that after the drilling had ceased and a week later that any fumes that were there were dissipated. What we're saying in the conservation community is that there should be reserves where Ohioans can go and recreate with their family and not have to worry about these things, and that our state parks are those reserves. That's the reason they were set up. They were set up for us to recreate there with our families and enjoy nature.
Tom Stewart, I want to give you a chance to respond before we go on a break.
I find it very hard that the DNR was not there for a week because they have to be there to witness the entire casing program from the spudding of the well to the time of TDs. So they witness
somebody
all
on
the cement
site
job.
During all the drilling.
They
everything.
Have to witness all the cementing jobs. They have to witness the emplacement of the casing. They have to witness the pad construction, and they have to witness the well stimulation process, and they have to witness the restoration. So they're there by law. They are there on a constant basis. I don't dispute with Cheryl that when a drilling operation is going on, that there wouldn't be some inconveniences to people living around the area. And there's no disputing that.
What is there to guarantee people, though? Because one of the things as we, grapple with this economic downturn in Ohio is regulatory resources. What kind of resources will ODNR have? What kind of resources will Ohio EPA have?
Good question.
EPA have to monitor and to watch for any problems?
Senate Bill 165. 2.5 times increased money to the oil and gas regulatory program that was lockboxed. It can only be used. It cannot be seized by the legislature. It can only be used for the oil and gas regulatory program for the purpose of protecting human health, safety, and the environment.
Okay.
That program has been reviewed 3 times now by a national organization that compares oil and gas state regulatory programs against a national set of guidelines on what are the proper elements for a state-based program. All three times, the most latest is just being issued this month as it relates specifically to hydraulic fracturing, says that the state regulatory program is one of the better in the nation. The person, one of the persons on the review team that did the most recent peer critique view of the Ohio regulatory program is the same person that founded Oil and Gas Accountability Project, serves on their board, and serves on Earthworks board. Okay. And she was part of the statement that it's one of the better programs in the country.
Well, we're out of time for this segment. Cheryl, John Cox, you're welcome to stay. We're going to joining us when we return, Nadia Steinzer of Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project, which Tom Stewart just mentioned. Tom is the Executive Vice President of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association. Cheryl John Cox is Executive Director of the Buckeye Forest Council. Cheryl, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you,
appreciate
man.
It.
I appreciate it.
I don't think this is a topic that'll go away, and hopefully you can join us again. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Betty Friedan's 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique, helped launch a new wave of feminism. Stephanie Kuntz has written a new book about the women who read Friedan's book. Many of them were anxious about their femininity and guilty about their aspirations. On the next Fresh Air, Kuntz talks about how their experiences and anxieties shape the way feminism has been defined. Join us.
Fresh Air begins at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News, and there are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. You can do that at WOSU.org/email. It's 28 degrees in downtown Columbus, a slight chance of snow today, cloudy skies and a high of 29 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 20 degrees, a slight chance of snow for Thursday and a high right around 29. And there's a 40% chance of snow Thursday night, a low of 23 degrees. Hosted by award-winning journalist Tom Ashbrook, On Point is a show with a lively conversation that covers everything from breaking news to ancient poetry. It features writers, politicians, journalists, artists, scientists, and ordinary citizens from around the world. Listen to On Point weekday afternoons at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We've been talking about proposals to allow oil and gas drilling in Ohio state parks. There's already oil and gas drilling in Ohio land. What they're talking about would be getting legislation passed that would give the state the authority to allow it on its state parks. Big difference for a lot of people, one of whom is Alan, and we have an email from Alan. He says, please ask them how the state will identify and protect historically important areas such as Native American and Euro-American cemeteries, archaeological sites, and traditional cultural properties that could be impacted by drilling operations and related infrastructure such as the construction of pipeline roads, etc. Now, is that the sort of thing that regulations could prevent drilling near, or that the state could, on a case-by-case basis, say no to?
I fully agree that that's a concern that needs to be addressed. That's part of the regulatory program that, at least in my view, would be that would have to be addressed and set up. It would be part of the lease terms and conditions state would impose on whoever was awarded a lease. This is how you're going to do it. These are the things you're going to take into consideration. This is how you're going to stay out of our way.
Would the state – I mean, could the legislation include rules that the state must conduct studies themselves, or that there's, I mean, all of those kind of things are still in play, right?
I wouldn't have a problem with that at all.
Okay.
It's the public trust. We got to be, you know, I agree with Cheryl. It's the public trust that we have to be, that we're talking about here. And the true debate, I think, is hit here. The debate is, These lands are set aside for the public trust and for their recreation and enjoyment. Now, is that a violation to let this happen? Apparently Michigan and Pennsylvania don't think so.
Colorado is looking at it. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other states, but a lot of it's driven by economics. It's not driven necessarily by...
You know, I had an environmentalist that I knew well and respected. We were debating ANWR, the famous ANWR. And, you know, ANWR is a Saudi Arabian class oil field. You know, the resources there are undeniably huge for America. And he finally said something that, you know, I said, you know, finally we've come to agreement, John. He said, you know, Tom, there's just some places you shouldn't go. As it relates to ANWR, I, you know, for the first time, somebody presented to me a valid argument. And I think that's the argument that's being debated today between Cheryl, me, and the discourse that happened in the legislature. Is there places that you shouldn't go, or can we afford to keep that attitude? Because right now the parks are struggling, and there's resource out there. It's undeniable. It's out there. Despite what anybody says, the track record, I mean, there's been over 250,000 wells drilled in the state of Ohio. 250,000 wells, there's 60,000 wells that are producing right now. You can say there's a fault out there, but frankly, a fault is a geologic trap. It's what keeps the oil and gas in the ground, not lets it go out.
I want to move on. I want to get more into the detail of the fracking, what it means, and joining us help with that discussion is Nadia Steinzer of Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project. Nadia, thanks for waiting and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann, and great to be on. Hello to everyone else as well.
Nadia, what is the main objection to the fracking process as it pertains? Tom Stewart just said there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of well sites all over the state of Ohio, and no one really talks about fracking as an environmental problem in Ohio.
First of all, I just want to clear something up that Tom asserted before, because he continues to assert this, and that's that the Oil and Gas Accountability Project founders support his statement that Ohio has the strongest, some of the strongest regulations in the nation,
that's not
and that
accurate.
We're involved in that. And I would just like to say that that's not true. The review he's referring to was an assessment based on some guidelines. And our founders would not agree with his assessment. So I just wanted to clear that up in terms of Earthworks and the Oil and Gas Accountability Project. When it comes to hydraulic fracturing, you know, I think there's been a real focus on the fracturing per se, and then a lot of industry reps say, well, it's been used before. It's used in 90% of oil and gas wells today.
Right.
But what we're really talking about is a large-scale industrial process of gas development, of which very high-volume hydraulic fracturing with horizontal drilling would take place. And that is something new in the state of Ohio to recover gas from deep shale formations, such as the Marcellus and the Utica. So it is a different process that's being discussed now than what the state and many other states have experienced before. So from our perspective, part of the problem is that the regulations and the assessments that have been used in the past may not or probably are not adequate to determine the risks and weigh the relative costs and benefits.
What would be adequate? What would it take?
Most states right now, including others that are forging ahead with deep shale gas extraction, haven't done any kind of cumulative impact study to understand what it would mean over time to have this kind of high volume drilling in terms of water supplies, water quality, you know, comparison with population densities, where you would have the wells, so that the regulations that may be currently in place, and you know, to Ohio's credit, they're starting to integrate considerations around hydraulic fracturing and other types of drilling into the regulations.
Mm-hmm.
It's not based on an assessment about what this industry would do in general to resources and to populations. It's based on whether, you know, we've done it before and we've had X number of problems, thus we can go forward. And when it comes to state land, that's a real consideration because, this is a high industrial process and would have a serious impact on both water supplies and other values of the state forest, both in terms of recreation and wildlife and resource protection, which is part of the mandate of the state forests.
So, Tom, you know, a lot of people are still reeling from what happened down in the Gulf, that everyone assured them that this couldn't hurt anything, and hundreds of miles away, beaches were destroyed. People are still cleaning up. What do you think it takes to regulate this kind, this new kind of drilling, the horizontal drilling in the fracking process?
Well, first one statement. The state reviews that have happened of the Ohio Oil and Gas Regulatory Program have all happened by teams that include environmentalists, state regulators, US EPA, US DOE, and the industry. The most recent review that was specifically focused on hydraulic fracturing, the review team included the founding member of Oil and Gas Accountability Project and sits on their board. She is also on the board of the organization that did it, as am I. She voted to approve the report, and the report speaks for itself. It's one of the better programs out there, and it does a great job. Now, that's just a fact. Now, let's try to avoid comparisons to British Petroleum's Macondo well in Deep Horizon. There's a well that's in deep water making 100,000 barrels
of oil a day. It's completely different, yeah. But
it's a federal program.
But the public's perception,
I agree with you on that, yeah,
is what is reality for, yeah, a lot of people. Yeah. That's our latest experience with disaster.
A Macondo class well is not reality in the state of Ohio. So if we're going to say what is reality, you're not going to have a Macondo-style project in
No, but you do
Ohio.
Have private interest.
I go back in the industry.
I think the parallel is that you have private industry that for profit that makes money off these wells.
Their
goal is
money.
To make money, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think the public wants and is more concerned than they might have been 2 years ago about where are the public's interests in this and where does the profit motive take precedence, yeah, over the security of our environment.
That goes back to what we were discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. What they expect and demand, what the public demands, is faith and trust in the state regulatory program that is designed specifically to manage the industry as it specifically exists in any one state or region. So, what do we need? We need a properly structured state regulatory program that has the funding, the resources under law, the enforcement abilities under law, which Senate Bill 165 dramatically addressed. They need all those elements in place so that they can believe that the public interest is being taken care of as it relates to this industry. It's about managing risk, and it's not about eliminating risk. It's about managing risk.
Nadia, we talked earlier about how many wells in one area around the Salt Fork Park in Ohio. It's surrounded by drilling sites, and there haven't been any complaints in the park so far. So what difference would it make to put drilling inside the parks?
Well, obviously, if you put it inside the park, then that would be a different equation and different, you know, likelihood of issues than if they're outside the park, especially because I'm assuming that the drilling outside the park are vertical wells, low volume, and again, that we're talking about a different kind of operation, mm-hmm, here, which would... And also, once it's inside the park, you know, these well pads also, they're large scale. I don't know if they would involve injection or impoundments for water or wastewater. You'd have a lot of trucking. There'd be roads. One of the key concerns for state land and public lands in general with the oil and gas industry, and it's coming up strongly in Pennsylvania and also in New York, mm-hmm, is road fragmentation and just carving up intact state forest areas, which are often, you know, sort of small postage-sized areas, areas.
Governor Kasich mentioned that in terms of the Mahoning Valley and putting wells there, and that's on just, you know, that has nothing to do with the parkland.
Right, so even setting aside for the moment the risk of contamination and the risk, you know, the increased air pollution and risks that are involved to state land, which, you know, the public is held in the public trust and is considered generally to be very precious resources. Even setting that aside, you just have the issue of an industrial practice on forested or preserved areas, maybe not necessarily forested, that have been set aside for different purposes other than industrial development. So that is the key difference. And, you know, as Tom has pointed out, it's a question of managing risk. But the problem right now is that assessments of whether this should be done are not taking into account the real risks on the ground that are happening in other places. I mean, there is just case after case after case of contamination, health problems. You know, just in Pennsylvania this week, they're looking into a huge well blowout that happened on state land. There was another one in June, spilled thousands of gallons of toxic chemicals.
Well, Nadia, that's what I wanted to get at that briefly. We only have a few more minutes left in the program, and as I said earlier before you came on, this isn't the last show about this topic. But fracking, there's a chemical involved. What happens to the water, and where does the water go after it's used in this process?
Well, a variety of places. I mean, the estimates are that about 60% or so of the wastewater comes back up, and it is laced with chemicals. I mean, industry will often claim that it's only half of 1% of the fracturing fluids that are injected is chemicals, and that the rest is water and sand, and that might be true, but the volume that you're talking about in deep shale drilling is such that it could be anywhere from, you know, 10 to 40,000 gallons of a chemical mix.
And it mixes with the water that's
right.
used to fracture the shale.
Yeah, and a lot of it does come back up, and that water is generally, in many states, held in very large impoundments that can be acres long.
Can it be treated?
Some companies are attempting to recycle it and use it again. That is a major concern in this process is how it's being treated and whether it's being treated sufficiently given that the chemicals used are considered to be hazardous and toxic chemicals. So municipal wastewater plants are generally not set up to handle this kind of chemical.
But there is one in Ohio that is certified. They're doing a one-shot deal on it, apparently, treating the fracking water but only once, and again, it's to make some money.
Right, and again, I mean, I think the major problem here in all of these states that are doing this, and with Ohio considering moving in this direction with the high volume drilling, is needing to look at make sure that we have the systems in place, including wastewater treatment, prior to starting this operation. Because right now what you're finding in, you know, Pennsylvania is they're producing all this stuff and they don't always have a place to go put it or
okay.
treat it adequately. And you're already seeing impacts on some of the major rivers
okay.
And water supplies in the state of Pennsylvania because there wasn't proper planning in place. This is a lot of wastewater.
That's true. I mean, we talked about Pennsylvania earlier. Nadia, I want to say thanks to you. I want to give Tom, you know, the final. We only have a minute left. So, yeah, I know time flies, but I hope you'll join us again, Nadia Steinzer.
I'd be delighted to. Thanks for having me.
Tom, you got about 40 seconds.
You know what?
Thanks for your patience.
I share her concern with disposal of this material in streams. I'm opposed to that. In 1985, Ohio law said that produced waters, which are not considered hazardous waste pursuant to Resource Conservation Recovery Act, and according to Safe Drinking Water Act. But my view is that these produced waters be put down Class 2 wells specifically designed pursuant to Safe Drinking Water Act, which everybody says we're exempt from, but apparently not, that ought to all that water should be done in Class 2. Horizontal wells is essentially a process where you carry 10 wells in one well bore.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that the minimization of surface impact, instead of drilling 10 wells, you do it all in one well, you would think that most people would like that.
That's all the time we have, Tom Stewart. I'm sorry. I hope you'll join us again.
Bill, I'd be happy. We didn't scratch the surface.
We didn't scratch the surface. Yeah. No pun intended. Thanks for joining us today. We'll talk about this again. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.